Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. I hope you had a fantastic weekend. We have so much going on. It's almost overwhelming and very consequential. Ainsley Earhart's going to be joining me shortly. Kathy Lee Gifford at the bottom of the hour. She's got a brand new book out. Might be the most interesting person you could ever talk to at any moment in your life. And then we'll take your calls. I know you have a lot of opinions about what's going on. We know that any minute a vice presidential selection could be made. We also are tracking what's going on with this storm. It's slamming into the south. It's now touched land. It's slamming into the south. So hang on tight. So let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three. We've seen four consecutive months where the unemployment rate is creeping up. And you put that together with the earnings reports from Starbucks and McDonald's. And all of a sudden, we started to worry that maybe consumers are under pressure. Then we get this generalized fear that the economy is slowing down, maybe headed into a recession. That caused stocks to sell off last week in the U.S.
Okay, you got it now? Where the stock market's down 1,000 points. Not good. The American economy beginning to shake as bad jobs numbers and a cratering stock market as world markets taking a beating. This is a top issue for most of this election, most of you this election, and could derail Harris weeks before her convention.
Number two.
The Iranian-backed Shia militias in Iraq and Syria prior to October the 7th had already fired at U.S. troops 125 times. We still do not hold Iran accountable, and it's a huge strategic mistake.
It's true, General Jack Keane. Middle East braces for a massive attack on Israel after they took out three high-ranking terrorists, one in Tehran, one in Lebanon, and one in Gaza. We stand by to help, but the administration spends most of their time showing weakness and criticizing Israel.
Number one.
There's a lot of irrational exuberance on the side of on the Democratic side of the aisle right now because there was despair for some period of time about what November was going to look like. Now people feel like there's a chance. It is absolutely Trump's race to lose right now.
Yep, that is David Axelrod and Barack Obama saying the same thing. They're underdogs. They're underdogs. They're underdogs. It's a mindset. It gets people motivated. Don't fall for it. Campaign 2024, the polls tighten. Trump attacks and Harris hides. From the press, that is, who don't seem to care. Don't seem to care that she doesn't do any interviews. Well, we do. Plus, Harris VP pick is hours away. We'll look at it. And keep in mind, too, if Trump wasn't doing interviews, I'd be asking every day. I wanted an interview. I mean, if Mitt Romney wasn't giving interviews, I'd be asking every day. John McCain asking every day. It doesn't matter what party. What do you do for a living? I mean, if you want to give a softball interview, that's another thing. But if you want to, why is it okay for someone to run for president, not run through any primaries, not get one primary vote, get anointed the head of the party running it, vice president running the party, and the administration, we're to believe. And then it's okay not to even know where she stands on anything. Then you get stories. She changed her stance on immigration. She's changed her stance on private health insurance. She changed her stance on offshore drilling. She's changed her stance on fracking. She changed her stance on Israel. Oh, excuse me? Really? Since when? On sanctuary cities, too. You're not even going to say it. You don't even put it in a speech, but you have people leak it to major organizations. Why is that okay? Here's more from Axelrod. Cut one.
There's a lot of irrational exuberance on the side of on the Democratic side of the aisle right now because there was despair for some period of time about what November was going to look like. Now people feel like there's a chance. It is absolutely Trump's race to lose right now. He is ahead, and he is ahead most of the battleground states. They're close. They could be won by either candidate.
Yeah, that is true. David Axelrod has been the voice of reason, kind of like the Karl Rove here. He'll come out and criticize Trump, even though you know he's a conservative. David Axelrod wants every Democrat to win, but he's hired to give analysis. Plus, he's posturing. There's no doubt about it. He's posturing because he has definite access. He didn't have access to Biden. He knew what was going on. But now this is like Obama light. It's David Plouffe is now part of their organization. So that means a lot. It turns out if Shapiro becomes the vice president, I did not realize how deep the relationship goes with Shapiro really being mentored by Barack Obama. I know he sounds exactly like Barack Obama, but now we find out he's being mentored. Then the relationship with Kamala Harris goes back 20 years. So this is really Obama 3, more than Biden was Obama 3. Here's Amy Walter. I thought this was pretty cool. You know, the Cook Political Report. She's one of the higher ups there. I think she's actually running it now. So Ed O'Keefe filled in on Face the Nation. He's the one who asked the question. Cut to.
The fundamentals of the race are still leaning in Trump's direction. Yeah. Remind the viewer why.
Yeah. And Anthony also highlighted this, too. She is new. And yet she's not new. She's new to a lot of voters. She's not defined very well in the minds of a lot of voters. But she is the incumbent. And the incumbent party right now has a lot of baggage, notably the frustration about the state of the economy, what we saw in the CBS poll, what we're seeing in other polling like the Wall Street Journal poll, where Donald Trump still has a sizable lead on who do you think would do a better job on the economy, who would do a better job on handling the border. On the question of who has better temperament to be president, Harris has a significant advantage there.
Right. That's fine. On the other things that really matter, we all know Donald Trump. On the things that matter in the performance, he grades out high. And the economy. So if you ask people, I got it right here. They asked people in the ABC poll in the battleground states, what's the most important? So it goes like this. In Michigan, they said 35% said the economy number two is immigration 17. Now, let me ask you, have you seen a poll that showed Trump without a double-digit lead in both those areas? I have not. Abortion is third at 16%. In Minnesota, the economy, 33% said economy is most important. 16% said immigration is, and 15% said abortion. It's almost the same exact thing in Pennsylvania, only it said 40%, 39%, and Wisconsin, 37%. So this is what they're talking about. It's the performance. And look at the foreign policy. I mean, the Middle East is on fire. Eastern Europe is on fire. Our enemies have united together in a way they weren't even united together in World War II. You know, Japan and Italy were not coordinating with Japan. Germany and Italy were not coordinating with Japan. They were axis of evil all fighting the West, but they weren't coordinating. These North Korea, Russia, Iran, and China will be together. They're coordinated doing military exercises. That's under this guy. So please don't tell me foreign policy is better. This is so obvious Trump's to lose, and his ratings have never been better. However, over the weekend, coming out, going after Brian Kemp is dumb. Now, Kemp is doing a bad thing, too. I think that he's a respected governor, but he's not using his ground game to help out in Georgia. The former president's still winning in Georgia, but why are you doing that? Now, for Trump, he should keep his powder dry and let it leak out that he's upset, not use time. Now, I watched the whole Trump address, the whole rally, because I was live Saturday night, 9 o'clock on One Nation, and I wanted to be able to recap it coherently. Now, Trump for three quarters was perfect. He was Trump. Pack plays, crowd chanting his name. They're all pumped up. They had a lot of people. I don't know. It was real good. But when he went after Kemp, when talked about the last election, it's a total waste of time. It's a dry hole. And when it comes to Kamala Harris, no reason to bring up our IQ. Whatever you think her IQ is, I don't care. It doesn't matter. So I don't get it. I mean, it is really his to lose. And I just hope they stay a little bit more active. For some reason, I don't have any events for them. You know, looking at the campaign, Tuesday, Harris will be in Pennsylvania. It makes me think Governor Shapiro's the pick. On Wednesday, Harris will be in Wisconsin and Michigan. On Thursday, Harris will be in Michigan, North Carolina, and Georgia. On Friday, Harris will be in Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. On Saturday, Harris will be in Nevada and California. At which time, somebody's got to ask her a question. But right now, I don't have any events for Trump until Friday. They could get something together quick. I'd like to see it. You can't lose a week. No, you can't lose a week. Then they got the DNC week. You can't lose a week, in my view. And so far, let me just give you an idea. CBS did a poll. Nationally, 50-49 Harris. On the battleground states, it's 50-50. 538 did a poll, has Harris up 4 in Wisconsin, has Harris up 1.8 in Michigan, in Pennsylvania 0.5, Arizona's Trump by 2, even in Nevada, Georgia Trump by 1, North Carolina Trump by 3. It's going to be a battle, but it's easily, could easily go Trump's direction. Leadership, strength, economy, foreign policy, all immigration, all his direction. What do you think? Ames is going to join us next. She talked to Usha Vance. Usha Vance, who is the wife of J.D. Vance, and did a great interview with that. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show.
This ad furnished by Nesmontage LLC. Offer not valid in all states or where prohibited by law. Loans are subject to lender approval. See website for details.
Honey, the credit card bill came, and we're maxed out.
Great. Maxed out cards, rent is due, bills are piling up. We just need some extra cash to help us get by.
We should do what my brother did. He went to GetCash.com and got $3,000.
With our bad credit?
GetCash.com is different. They're one of the largest personal loan networks. They can help people with any type of credit get up to $5,000.
I'm sure there's a lot of paperwork.
Nope. My brother said it was fast and easy. He did it right from his phone.
If you have a regular source of income, you can be approved for a loan of up to $5,000 in minutes, and your cash can hit your bank account as soon as the next day. Our lenders have millions of dollars to lend regardless of your credit history.
Great news. I went to GetCash.com and we'll have our money as soon as tomorrow.
Wow, that is fast.
If you need extra cash, go to GetCash.com. That's GetCash.com. GetCash.com.
Offer not valid in all states or where prohibited by law. Loans are subject to lender approval. See website for details.
Meet Brian. Brian seems pretty typical. Hardworking, lives modestly, but has gotten a little behind with bills. Except Brian just got $5,000 deposited into his bank account. Yep, $5,000, and it was actually quite easy. I'll tell you how Brian did it in 30 seconds. Brian was in need of cash help. After being rejected by banks, family, and friends, he decided to try GetCash.com. He filled out their questionnaire in minutes right from his phone, listed how much he needed, and even let them know he had bad credit. Almost instantly, GetCash.com found a lender who approved him for $5,000. Brian now has cash to use however he wants, pay bills, rent, or use it for a vacation. Best part, the money hit Brian's bank account the very next day. And just like that, Brian no longer needed cash help. If you need cash help for any reason, even if you have bad credit like Brian, go to GetCash.com. That's GetCash.com.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, I think everyone's doing really well. It's been such an adventure. You know, obviously, this is like nothing we've done before. And everyone's just been really kind since we started this. There have been so many people volunteering to help us understand how to do everything. I can't thank people enough for that.
What has been the biggest adjustment? Life has changed a lot.
Yeah, the Secret Service is a big change. And I have to say, I mean, they've been amazing. They've really taught us an incredible amount over the last couple weeks about how to live with a security detail and all of that. But that certainly is a change. We have code names now. Our kids had a lot of fun with that.
There you go. And that is Usha Vance talking to Ainsley Earhart. It would be great to be able to talk to Ainsley Earhart about her interview.
So, Brian, you can talk to me who talked to Usha.
Is that okay?
And we can talk to the people and tell them what she's like.
We booked you. We managed to go through your people.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So
very
what did
nice
you do?
You
went to Cincinnati and you spoke to the could-be future second lady.
That's exactly right. And it's fascinating because we have this question will be saved for tomorrow, but we asked her what it's like. I mean, this is America. She has the American dream. Her parents immigrated here legally from India. She grew up in San Diego, and now she could be this possible second lady as an Indian American. And then she's Donald Trump is running against someone who is also an Indian American whose dad was from Jamaica. So that's the layout of America. And it's she just talked about the American dream and what this country has done for her and her family.
So sometimes you meet people with an Ivy League background, and you go, oh, they must have been a legacy. But when you listen to her,
if it were Ainsley, who helped her get in?
Well, George W. Bush said, he always said, he goes, I represent hope for C students everywhere.
Yeah.
And he obviously went to two Ivy League schools, but you were impressed with her intellect.
Very impressed. She's never made a B in her life. And I said, is this true? I'm reading this about you. And she said, well, she was so humble. You know, maybe on a, a test here and there. I don't remember. But, you know, for the letter grades at the end of the semester. Yeah, I've made A's.
Right.
And then I said, who's smarter, you or JD? And she started laughing. She said, well, we're both smart in different ways.
Right. She would have probably said her before he was running. In a second, and then you say that. But I listened to J.D. Vance on the Nelk Brothers, a very popular podcast. You realize how bright he is.
Yeah.
He could talk about society. He could talk about tech world. Mm-hmm. He talks about, obviously, marriage, life, poverty, success. He can go anywhere deep.
Right.
I think that he'll do better. He'll get rid of the controversy if he could just get out there and start fighting for Trump.
Yeah, he had a great interview with Maria on yesterday on Sunday Night Futures. And I was impressed with his answers. He thought right on the spot. She was asking, a lot of people are saying that they want Trump to pick a different VP. And he aced that answer, right? That was right out of the gate. She asked that question. And then she asked a few other questions and he answered them beautifully. So I think he is smart. I think he's great at this. It's always, you feel sorry for the spouse though, in the interviews, because you're like, how are they feeling? Are they nervous about this? They don't know what I'm going to ask them. And she did great.
So you asked the tough question that everyone's going to town with on the other networks about him making a statement about, a lot of this country is run, or the Democratic Party is run, by women who don't want to have kids and just want to live with their cats. And people went to town on this. So you asked her about it. Cut 26.
What do you say to the women who were offended or were hurt by that?
Well, I think I would say, first of all, that JD absolutely at the time and today would never, ever, ever want to say something to hurt someone who was trying to have a family, who really, was struggling with that. And he made that clear at the time. And he's made that clear today. And we have lots of friends who have been in that position. It is challenging and never, ever anything that anyone would want to mock or make fun of. And I also understand there are a lot of other reasons why people may choose not to have families. And many of those reasons are very good. I think what I would say is, let's try to look at the real conversation that he's trying to have.
So your thoughts about that question? She seemed to be ready for it. Mm-hmm. Did you think she might not have been ready for it?
You never know, because obviously I don't give my questions to them beforehand. But, I would hope that she would have been ready for that question. Every article I read, we studied. Our whole team got together and talked about what we thought was most important. Every article I read about her, every interview I watched about J.D. Vance or from J.D. Vance, that was the number one question last week. And that's what women all over America were talking about. So I would hope that she would have been prepared for that. Her answer, I thought was really graceful and elegant. And she said, it's really hard to be a parent in this society. And she said, he fights for family because he grew up in his background is so difficult. And he wrote Hillbilly Elegy. He grew up as a hillbilly and by a mom who did drugs. His grandmother helped raise him. If you watch the movie,
Glenn Close play?
Yes. Amy Adams played his mom. Yeah. And he grew up and how does he overcome his childhood? And she says, I don't think you ever overcome your childhood. You come to terms with your childhood. And he has learned a lot from his childhood. And those have been sources of strength for him as a husband, mm-hmm. as a father. But she said basically what she brings into his life that she's most proud of is family. Mm-hmm. And family means so much to him. But when he was talking about the cat lady, he was talking about Democrats who might not understand Republicans who have families and how they're struggling, not only because of inflation, but the more kids you have, obviously, the more expensive it is. And we want to promote family. If you're able to have a family, if you want a family, yeah. It's sad when you hear your friends say, we would love to have more kids, but we can't afford it.
Like Jennifer Aniston came out and said, I did IVF a bunch of times, didn't work. And then all of a sudden, one of the most famous people in the country coming after you, it's a problem. But
part two will be tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And it's about her life, growing up, her history, how she fell in love with JD, his life, Hillbilly Elegy, mm-hmm. and more about what it's like to be in the spotlight and mm-hmm. advice that she's gotten.
One thing that stands out right now, when people come in to do interviews here, we never bring people in, for the most part. Not only is Lexi here, she's actually sitting next to you. I mean, so Lexi, I mean, for you to come in here, the boldness
Lexi
that she showed.
She is our amazing assistant.
Right.
And I actually.
She broke protocol.
Isn't it
Allison,
funny?
Did you allow this?
Ainsley invited her to sit down.
Right.
So
she sat
down
last time. Are you not okay with having, you want your assistant to sit in the hallway?
You're just shaking me off. Lexi also does our live streams in the morning.
The funny thing is, we all want Lexi around. We want, like, not more cowbell. We need more Lexi, right?
And it's so sad when you go on interviews because you take her.
I know, sorry. And you miss her, right?
Right. Yeah. And when I say to her, hey, Lexi, I have a shoot coming up, she goes, all right, I'll be here. And she just says, I'll watch everything in back. And that makes me reassured. At least my office will be safe.
I'll tell you why. I need her more than you because I need to prepare more in the mornings than you do.
It's
You're just
power.
A natural.
It's a girl power thing. Lexi, great to see you. Despite what Ainsley says, it's always great. Congratulations on the interview.
Thank
I look forward
you.
To part two.
Thanks for promoting it.
All right, back in a moment.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. Thanks so much for being here, everybody. We're following a few stories, first of which is the market is off 1,100-plus points so far, and the Nikkei average over in Japan had its biggest drop since 1987. This is a little bit off the job numbers, a little bit off the lack of cutting of interest rates, which means people don't have confidence that inflation is going down. So we're watching all this because so much rides on the American economy, and then people get panicked and they react in group because this is one of the disadvantages of the electronic age. Without having that paper to run in and out, you could just do everything from your house. So we're keeping an eye on what's happening with the economy. Obviously, if they were running on Bidenomics for the longest time, this is the strongest economy in the world. I'm pretty sure they're gutting that speech right now. I'm talking about Harris, and I'm talking about Biden. They're also looking at the Middle East is on pins and needles because it looks like massive retaliations on order on Israel, who is not standing by, and we are standing by to help. A crazy time in the world, and what better time to bring in one of the most interesting people on the planet who has accomplished more in a third of her career than most do in three careers, and she's still going strong. Kathy Lee Gifford, former co-host of Fourth Hour of the Today Show, Regis and Kathy Lee, and now author of Herod and Mary. Kathy Lee, welcome back.
Oh, sweetie, you know I adore you, don't you? Don't tell anybody.
You know, why did we never host a show together? Like, why? With
you know
your power, you could have made that happen.
Do you know, remember when I told you years ago, to me you were like the young Regis. You really were. I said, you just so remind me of how he was. And you do, you're just, first of all, you're brilliant. Your books are so thoughtful and you research so well. And you're the passion that you have for what you do also reminds me of me, basically, because, you know, nobody, I don't have fun doing all these projects. You know, it's not fun. It's, but I have to do them. I have passion to do them. And you know, my walk of faith is so huge that I can't ignore it. And it just steams me like an engine. So anyway, but there are certain people in this world that I just get a kick and a hoot and a from. And that's you. So
well,
when I realized that I was going to be able to, you guys were gone when I was in New York. You guys were at the RNC, and I thought, oh, I don't get to see him.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, too, you attack me, which is great. I don't like when people are nice to me, and you tend to attack
me. I know, and I'm going to quit right now.
You promise?
A pain in the, yeah. It's no fun. It's not. It's just that you make me happy. That's it.
But you know what?
And I'm happy. I'm sitting here. You know, you probably know that I had my hip replaced. I didn't have a hip left. I was down to the nubs because of that career that you were just talking about. Literally, when my surgeon took my fixed me up, God love him, Dr. Dierkin at Southern Hills in wherever I live, Southern Hills Hospital. He said, Kathy, it's one of the worst hips I have ever seen in my life. And he said, how are you existing? I had been in pain for so long, and finally the pain was gone, and I thought, I'm back. You know, I'm back. I was, you know, had to promote the book, And I just rushed down a flight of stairs to open the door. It was hot outside, and my friend was in the heat downstairs waiting for me to open the door. And I missed a step. And the whole way down, I kept going, oh, Jesus, please, not my hip. Not my hip. No, Jesus, please. And the hip wasn't touched at all, but I fractured my pelvis in the front and my pelvis in the back. But let me tell you something, okay, you, I have had absolutely no pain.
Really?
Since I fractured. It was a terrible fracture, and it's supposed to be one of the worst painful things there is. I'm walking, I'm not walking around because they won't let me, but, you know, I have no pain. No pain. I'm so grateful to God for the, you know, most people are in a lot of pain,
right?
You know, and I, from day one, I've just thought, you know what, even if I was in pain from this, there are people in my own life that are in agony about whatever it is, whether it's something personal they're going through, or whether it's physical, or whether it's cancer, or, you know, the Lord lays us low sometimes, not to punish us, but to just to get attention, I think, sometimes for what's really, really important, and to truly pray and have empathy and compassion for people that are really hurting, you know. And if I could get on my knees, you know, there are times I can't even get up because there's so many people. And now Israel is about to be attacked again, and you know how I feel about Israel and going there and study. I have not been able to go for a year because of everything going on there. And, you know, I pray as well for the Palestinians, everybody that's in harm's way. God hates war. He hates war. He loves family. It's called Bet Av. And that's why when I go to Israel, and I have been since I was a kid, been going there and writing the books that I do and shooting the films that I make. There's a purpose for it, because I just want people to know that God loves them. And on one of my very first, what I call a rabbinical trip, meaning I studied the ancient Hebrew and I studied the ancient Greek. That's what the scriptures were originally written in. And that's the only way to get the real word of God. There's so many terrible translations of the Bible. And so I got fascinated. I became fascinated by Herod. You know, he's only mentioned a couple of times in the scriptures in the New Testament. And it's not flattering by any means, but I had no idea the impact this man had on history. I mean, with Julius Caesar. Did you have a chance to even look at it, Sweetie? I know you've been awfully busy.
So a couple of things. What I like most about your work, it's easy to say, okay, this is this psalm, this is this story, this is this reading, and this is what happens. But you go, no, I need to see the places. I need to see exactly where it happened. Because if you don't, it becomes a myth or a fairy tale that people say, we're just supposed to get meaning out of this story. It didn't really happen. And you said, no, it really happened. I'm going to go back to the place and see it. So why was that important for you to go back to talk to the historians, the archaeologists, and go to these places? What did it do for you?
Well, I wrote a book years ago, about 6 years ago, that changed everything for me. It's called The Rock, The Road, and The Rabbi. The rock is Jesus. The road is being in the Holy Land. There's nothing compares. And then the rabbi is rabbinical teaching. Not a rabbi, a particular one, but they always take you 10 layers down deeper into what the meaning of things actually is.
Right.
And so that's why it's important. That's why on a visual, you know, Jesus was a rabbi, and the rabbis, most of the people that followed the rabbis were not learned people. The rabbis would point to things, and it was always something that people could hear or smell or touch or feel, or it was always appealing to their senses so they would understand. So when I write everything I do, I try to appeal to people's senses the way the rabbis did, because, you know, not everybody can visualize like I do. I'm an artist. I visualize. I see. And then I try to make it approachable and understandable and relatable, to average person, but to anybody. And that's why I do movies. And that's why, you know, anyway, that's why it's important.
Gotcha.
Right?
So now tell me about Herod as it relates to Mary.
Well, Herod was at the end of his life when Mary was about to give birth to the Well, you know, Jesus, the king of all kings, he called himself a king of the Jews. He wasn't even a Jew. And Jesus is the king of all of humankind, creator of all things, along with his Father and the Holy Spirit. When there was nothing, there was Jesus. He was part of that whole thing. And people don't understand that. They think he just showed up 2,000 years ago and did some miracles and resurrected. Maybe a lot of people don't even believe that. I'm a part of producer of a new movie that's going to be coming out soon. Not soon, but it will be, about the shroud and what they've discovered scientifically. It's wow. Just so exciting. So, I mean, it's exciting to be part of everything that's being discovered now. But specifically about Herod, he was probably one of the most brilliant architects that ever lived. He was a genius in so many different things. And so many of the ruins are still there when you visit. And just he dug a marina. He went 120 or 50 feet into the Mediterranean Sea and built and poured concrete over 2,000 years ago. How did he do that? And that's so Caesar's ships could come in from Italy and bring his soldiers. Because he was a paranoid man, completely and totally paranoid, because the Jews hated him because he wasn't a Jew, but he was their leader. And he was constantly looking behind his back because you know, somebody like a Mark Antony wanted him. Or Julius Caesar. You know, he was in love and in lust with everything that you shouldn't be, it would destroy you. And Jesus once said, you know, what does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his very soul? That's the perfect picture of Herod. So my book begins, and I have to give credit to Dr. Brian Litvin, who co-wrote it with me. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. And I could not have written this book without him or Cody. It was my son Cody's idea to write it as a thriller. And it opens up with Herod at his Jericho palace, basically in the last days of his life, with his genitals just like charcoal hanging off his body. And the stench was so bad that even his slaves could not come near him. He had maggots and, you know, you get the picture.
Yeah.
That's what the richest man in the world had become. And he was going around going, Miriam, that's his wife that he had murdered. He murdered his children. He murdered his wife, the only woman he had ever loved. He murdered thousands and thousands of people. He even ordered that when he died, 300 other people would be put to death too, people that were revered and loved, so that there would actually be mourning in Israel.
In the end, it doesn't pay to get everything you want if you have no morals and no character.
If you lust after anything other than the truth of the Lord, you know, and he did. I mean, he had every disease you could possibly have. I mean, Cleopatra tried to seduce him. He might be the only man that said actually no to Cleopatra, because she was with Mark Antony, and he said, "Oh no, can't get Mark Antony mad." I mean, these are the kinds of things. How would we know this stuff?
See, I think
of it is because of Josephus, who is a Jewish historian who's considered the finest historian of those days. He's written many, many books so that was the main one. But there were other things. We know very little about Mary. She was obviously the mother of Jesus, but in scripture, there's not a whole lot. So we had to go to some other sources, and everything is footnoted.
Gotcha.
It's very, very important to me that anything that we shared is on purpose, you know. And so what I tried to do, sweetie, is juxtapose a dying Herod, who to this day would be considered probably the richest man that ever lived, and perhaps the most brilliant that ever lived. He was that guy. Juxtaposed up against the beauty and the purity and the holiness of a teenager from Nazareth who just said yes to God, who said, "You will be with child, and you will name him Jesus, and he will save the world from their sins."
Wow.
And she said, "Let it be unto me as you have said." That's the kind of person that I want to be. I want to say yes to God. And I haven't many, many times in my life, Brian. And I've regretted it every time. The times I listen to God and obey him, and even right now when I'm, you know, I'm not my full self by any means, I want to be faithful. I just want to be faithful.
Right. Hey, listen, you're a lot more perfect than almost everybody listening right now, including me. So I think you're there.
Well, I'm way more perfect than you. Everybody knows that.
Now, the only thing I have better is a pelvis. I have a better pelvis right now. But that'll change, too, when you get better.
I have heard legendary stories about your pelvis. Truly.
Right. And okay, go ahead. I got some time. Let's hear. Now, unfortunately, you know, because you grew up in television, that I'm up against a break. But, I mean, we could go on forever. The passion is so clear. I know everyone out there says, well, I read the Bible. I know everything. Not so. Herod and Mary is now out. Pick it up. Kathy Lee put it together. Her son gave her the great idea to make it a thriller. And it should be a movie.
Yeah, that's the plan. Okay. And it's the first in a series. The next one's going to be about Nero and the Apostle Paul, because wherever there was evil in the Garden of Eden, the certain, you know, right. People think it's, oh, I know you're up against a break, and but God was there too. I want people to have hope. Mm-hmm. Hope. It's called Ancient Evil, Living Hope. Cling to God. He's our living hope.
All right, and God, right now, put the power in me to go to break. I hope you don't mind.
Nobody does it better, little Regis.
that is an honor. I mean, he was the best ever. Kathy Lee Gifford, sure thanks was. So much. Pick up Herod and Mary. Great book. Back in a moment.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Before COVID, I would have told you that vaccines are the most important invention in human history. After COVID, I'm like, I don't think we went to the moon. The funniest way for me to die is if I die from COVID. Don't think I didn't think it. When I got COVID, the first thought I had was like, oh my God, you better not die. I talk so much. I talked so much. If I die from COVID, the memes would never end. It would be me with two X's for eyes holding a can of horse paste. Apparently, fear was a factor. This is a true story. One time, I just woke up. I'm in my underwear. I plop down in front of the TV. I turn it on. The moment I turn it on, Prince Harry's talking shit about me. I'm like, I just woke up. I'm vulnerable. I'm in my underwear, and there's a prince on TV. Do you know how weird it is when a prince knows your name? He's like, Joe Rogan's giving out dangerous vaccine misinformation.
Yeah, I love that he did it. I love they put current events, but that was him live on Netflix. I'm sure it's archived now. What was it, 8 o'clock on Saturday, Joe Rogan?
I don't remember the exact time, yeah. But it's quite the montage.
But yeah, it was. It's great. I mean, there's nobody hotter right now. And by the way, the most deceiving thing that I have seen is a headline saying that Kamala Harris, Joe Rogan thinks Kamala Harris will win. He's saying right now, if the press did, what's the matter?
No, it was so good. They actually talked about this on the Big Weekend show, and that how MSNBC, we won't have time to play it here, but at another point in the show, how they, you know, deceptively edited that clip. And then he ended up talking about Tulsi Gabbard as well. And then Tulsi responds to it on Twitter. It's mind blowing.
So Michael Malice, who I think is a great guest, says controversial things. He's a great guest for Rogan. So Rogan, like Mike Malice, still thinks Trump's going to win. And by the way, these aren't Trumpers. Neither one of these guys are Trumpers. They're just giving their opinion. And he said, right now, if the press continues to give her an easy time like this, not ask her any questions, and they're pretending as if she has been this great vice president, she can go ahead and win. And then Malice says, I don't think so. And then he goes, yeah, maybe not. So that was the whole context. Again, same thing with J.D. Vance. I know everybody's so busy, especially with podcasts. They go on and on and on. Take some time and just don't let a headline, even if I write the headline, don't let a headline let you think that's the conclusion. So many times in the piece, when you read the body of the piece, it's a totally different story. When you get to the body of the interview, it's a totally different story. Thanks so much for listening. Keep it here at BrianKilmeade.com to find out more. Your comments always welcome.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, heard around the world. I appreciate you being here. This hour will be great and important. We have a lot of breaking news, too. Some of it good, all of it interesting, and all of it matters. Michael Goodwin is standing by. And then we have Link Lauren, former RFK Jr. campaign advisor, political commentator, bringing us up to date on what's happening. By the way, RFK Jr. making some crazy news about his past and a bear. Hard to explain. But we're looking at the economy taking over everything, and I'll explain in a moment. But I would say the market looks like it's down 937 points right now, and overseas are getting killed because people believe America might be going to a recession. We'll discuss it. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three. We've seen four consecutive months where the unemployment rate is creeping up. And you put that together with the earnings reports from Starbucks and McDonald's. And all of a sudden, we started to worry that maybe consumers are under pressure. Then we get this generalized fear that the economy is slowing down, maybe headed into a recession. That caused stocks to sell off last week in the U.S.
American economy beginning to shake as bad jobs and bad job numbers and cratering stock market as world markets taking a beating. This is a top issue for most of us this election season and could derail Harris weeks before her convention.
Number two.
The Iranian-backed Shia militias in Iraq and Syria prior to October the 7th had already fired at U.S. troops 125 times. We still do not hold Iran accountable, and it's a huge strategic mistake.
General Jackine, always on the money. Middle East braces for a massive attack on Israel after they take out three high-ranking terrorists in about 3 days. We stand by to help as Americans, but this administration spends most of their time showing weakness and criticizing Israel.
Number one.
There's a lot of irrational exuberance on the side of on the Democratic side of the aisle right now because there was despair for some period of time about what November was going to look like. Now people feel like there's a chance. It is absolutely Trump's race to lose right now.
Well, they want to be the underdog, but David Axelrod speaking the truth. Polls tighten, Trump attacks, Harris hides. From the press, that is, who don't seem to care. We do, plus Harris's VP selection is hours away. We look at it all. And I'll tell you, Michael Goodwin, as I welcome you in for the New York Post, I don't know if they delay the pick because this economy and what's happening with the stock market is by far and away the number one story affecting all of us.
Good morning, Brian. Yes, and I would say it is the flip side of Joe Biden's bragging points, which is that jobs created, much of that was by virtue of inflation. And so now, as the Federal Reserve tries to wring inflation out of it, the kind of soul-sapping inflation that we have seen in this country, you have to slow the economy down to do that. And when you do that, of course, stocks fall, more jobs will be lost, businesses will close. I mean, we are entering sort of the winter of inflation now. It was bad when the prices were rising so quickly, but now that a lot of the support and the money supply that was flooding the world with money is now being dried up, and you're getting the other side of the equation. Neither side is a happy one for the average American family.
Here's what Trump said Saturday night, cut 39.
So here's what we're doing. We're going to get the first thing. We're going to get energy way down. Drill, baby, drill. All right. We're going to get energy way down. That's going to lead to the inflation. What's killed this country more than anything in the last 3.5 years is inflation inflicted upon this country by sleepy Joe Biden. The inflation has been a disaster in this country, and it's killed the middle class. It's killing the working class. And we're going to get inflation brought down. We have to bring prices down.
And the problem is when the Fed doesn't reduce interest rates, it's because they fear inflation is too stubborn and going up. And since they didn't reduce it, the word is, uh-oh, look out. Then jobs numbers come in. Unemployment's up to 4.3%, I think a 6-year high. And then on top of that, 114,000 instead of 144,000 jobs added. People have no faith that this administration didn't spend us into this. What's amazing to me is they're trying to blame Trump for the inflation, which is insane. He gave a, it was under 2% under Trump.
You know, Brian, I agree with you. It's insane, but I no longer believe that there is kind of this sensible American middle out there that is going to recognize the facts. I mean, the way the country has turned to support Kamala Harris after mocking her, even Democrats mocked her, but suddenly she's the savior of America. I mean, where is the common sense in all of this? Where are the facts? Where are the people who understand the facts? They're not showing up in the polls, that's for sure, because this is insane what has happened. I mean, that Joe Biden was too decrepit to be the nominee, and suddenly Kamala Harris, who was the laughingstock of the administration, she was the funniest thing about the administration. Every time she opened her mouth, it was hilarious. And now suddenly she's going to save America from all of this? Where is the middle? Where are the people who understand what has happened here, just as we're discussing about the economy? You get the sense that maybe most people don't pay attention to the cause and effect in ways that would make sense. They don't like the effect, but they didn't mind the cause on the way up, and that's the problem. I mean, a lot of people knew all of that Washington spending, which continued long after COVID, is what caused the inflation. I mean, the simplest explanation I've ever heard of inflation is too much money chasing too many goods. And so when three people want to buy the same house, the price of the house goes up dramatically in many cases. And that's what's happened to all of our consumer economy. Everything you want to buy, the prices have gone up faster than your income. That's what inflation has done to this country. And for anyone to think that Kamala Harris or any other member of the Biden administration who supported those policies can fix it hasn't been paying attention.
What's pretty amazing is Kamala Harris can't fix anything. She, if you read her track record, gets less impressive by the day. And then you see her performance for the last 3.5 years, you would think that there's no way that she would, that anyone would be getting behind her, because that was the best security blanket that Joe Biden ever had, because he knew he couldn't turn the reins over to her. But we're beginning to get an idea of what her campaign looks like as she pretends to be a moderate. She says, don't worry about decriminalizing border crossings. I didn't mean it. Don't worry about fracking, banning fracking. I don't believe that anymore. Offshore drilling, I don't believe that anymore. Sanctuary cities, she's not even going to bring it up. How about the immigration policies of the entire administration? She now says, I was a border czar. I was a great one. If she went from I'm not a border czar to now I'm a great border czar, which is incredible. But I want you to hear the guy that really alarmed me this weekend was Senator Murphy, because he was out and about basically saying that the Supreme Court has been bought and sold by corporate interests, and that we have to get the filibuster to change all these things about to change the Supreme Court. And he also said a bunch of crazy things, too. Cut 11.
Well, it started so high in part because of a series of crises that unfolded during the Trump administration. What drove the increase in migration was in part huge increased travel from a country like Venezuela, which was plunged into economic crisis because of Donald Trump's policies. Kamala Harris was given an important but discrete task. She was able to dramatically reduce migration from those countries. And again, apples to apples, crossings at the southwest border are lower today than they were at the end of the Trump administration.
So I'll help you with this. We just showed him a graphic that there were seven times lower than under Trump. Overall, 236% less. He said there was greater under Trump from those. She reduced them under Harris. Flat out lie. You're blaming Donald Trump for the turmoil in Venezuela? They've allowed China, Iran, and Russia into their country. They've gotten rid of all private industry. These people are running for their lives, and we finally called them out on it, and you're blaming Trump's policy on Venezuela? But here's the killer part. Listen to this on the Supreme Court.
I mean, I just don't think that democracy can allow for 40% of the United States Senate to stand in the way of progress that's popular with the American public. 90% of the American public supports background checks on gun sales. We can't pass that in the United States Senate, not because we can't get 50 United States senators, but because we can't get 60 United States senators. So there are many very popular proposals that we can't pass simply because of the filibuster. But let's talk for a second about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is captured by corporate interests today, and the American public knows that. So, yes, we should also have a conversation about what to do about a Supreme Court that is increasingly way out of step with the American public and with some members that are brazenly corrupt.
So what do you let that sink in for a second, everything he said. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's breathtaking deception, but it's also bizarre. Here is a United States senator talking in ways as though there is no constitution, that the Supreme Court should just go with the majority of what Americans think today on any topic that comes before them. Why then do we need a Supreme Court? Why not just take a straw poll every day and see how people are feeling when they wake up, and then we'll just that'll be the new law. I mean, and he's the whole filibuster issue is fascinating. The filibuster goes way back, but the idea of it is consensus, not bare majority, but consensus. So 60% in the Senate. I think that's a great rule of thumb for the country as a whole. If we could get 60% support for almost anything these days, we'd be a better country. But it was Harry Reid, the Democratic majority leader, the late Harry Reid, who broke the filibuster under Barack Obama because Obama was putting up a bunch of crappy judicial nominees who couldn't get 60 votes in the Senate. And so he made it a majority while Harry Reid was the majority leader. A majority of votes would be enough to get a federal judge appointed. And Republicans at the time, and especially Mitch McConnell, said, "You're going to regret this, because one day we're going to have the majority and we're going to work our will." And so when the Republicans got the majority, they said, "Okay, the filibuster not only is good for appellate courts and trial courts federally, it's good for the Supreme Court too." And so Republicans used their majority to put three new justices on Trump's first term. And that's what the Democrats are complaining about. So for him to cite the filibuster now is nonsensical. His party broke the filibuster. Why did they do that? They were warned that would get them. But they see, they've always counted on the Supreme Court as a super legislature. We can't get it through Congress, but the Supreme Court will do our bidding, because it was always headed by a liberal majority. Well, the shoe is on the other foot now, and they're wailing like babies.
Not only that, do they still feel the same way if Trump wins the presidency and the Republicans get the Senate? Is he still going to feel that way?
Right.
Of course not.
Right.
What are Republicans going to do? Yeah, by the way, the Republicans aren't going to get rid of the filibuster when they get the majority. They're not. It doesn't matter what Trump says. They don't feel it's responsible to their credit. They won't jam two states into America to their credit, D.C. and Puerto Rico. But just so you know, they plan on it. And the way he's talking about, the Connecticut senator is talking about the Supreme Court, sold out to corporate interests. Could you please tell me the corporation? Is he talking about Ketanji Brown? I'm not sure.
Yeah, most of the Supreme Court decisions are 9-0, the vast majority. So they all agree on what is constitutional or not in most cases. Mm-hmm. There are, of course, sharply divided cases as well. But how is that different from democracy itself? I mean, is everything have to be unanimous for Democrats to accept it? Can there be no dissent left? Is that, I mean, is this cancel culture come to the Supreme Court now?
It's incredible. And you write a great column about this and how it got bad. Remember, Harry Reid took great pride in making up a story that everybody knows Mitt Romney doesn't pay taxes. And then when asked about it, what proofs do you have? He goes, "I didn't. I made it up. But look who won." That's not the way
that's
it's supposed to
be. It worked. The lie worked.
Yeah, you tell Mitt Romney. By the way, Mitt Romney's walks on water now for Democrats. You tell Mitt Romney, "Oh, yeah, Mitt Romney was a sensible Republican." You made him be the second coming of the devil. You said that he was trying to destroy the families of poor people, a white supremacist, essentially. And then you'd say he doesn't pay any taxes. Now they wish for those days because of horrible Donald Trump. And then one day they'll look back and go, you know, I wish we had somebody as mainstream as Donald Trump. Who knows? Michael, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
mgoodwin_NYPost to follow him. Writes great columns every week. I want to take your calls next, 1-866-408-7669. I got a lot of emails already. You go to briankilmeade.com. A lot of you at work. And I'm getting a lot of them in. I'm tempted to read some out loud, but I'll wait. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So he was in a good place to make whatever decision, the top of his game. Such a consequential president of the United States, a Mount Rushmore kind of president of the United States.
Are
want
you
to
really
know what comes next?
That he belongs up there on Mount Rushmore, what? Lincoln and Joe Biden.
But you got Teddy Roosevelt up there, and he's wonderful. I don't say take him down, but you can add Biden.
I mean, are you just one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life? I thought it was the Babylon Bee. She actually thinks that Joe Biden, with his 36% approval rating, who can't get off a stage or make a sentence, belongs on Mount Rushmore. Funny memes show the back of Joe Biden's head on the mountain. And it's good to know that she's not for taking Teddy Roosevelt out of the mountain. That's a big relief. So Republicans, exhale for a second. I mean, why? This is the woman that stabbed him in the back, that made sure he was gone, started going up, started talking about how he should really decide whether he wants to run or not, when clearly he decided he wanted to run. When they said, you know what, if you have a problem with that, people should speak up if they have a problem. That gave everyone the green light to speak up about Joe Biden's diminished faculties. So she sits down with Leslie Stahl, not for 60 minutes, but she sits down and talks to Leslie Stahl that he should be on Mount Rushmore. And the one thing Leslie Stahl says to him, and I'll play it a different hour, I'll play it later, was he's furious with you. Oh, I love him. I mean, I understand it's the country first, but if you cared about the country, you would have got rid of, made sure he didn't run after 2022, let alone after 2020. But instead, you let him go for almost two years, go through every primary, make sure that nobody ran against him except Dean Phillips, who was saying what we all saw, what every Democrat now is agree on. The guy can't do it anymore. It's clearly not making the decision. So angry. And then he falls apart of the debate and she turns. The thing that I think surprised her when the book's written, I don't think she expected Kamala Harris to consolidate power like that and show ability to be the nominee. That's where she's in trouble.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Brian Kilmeade Show continues. We're still trying to follow the story with the stock market. The economy's cratering right now. It's dropped over 1,000 points. Our stock market, the futures were down, but this is really down. And the question is, what's going to stabilize it? The president of the United States basically says, I'm going to the Situation Room. And Iran has made it clear that we were not afraid of a total regional war, a wider war. Good luck with that. I mean, they're ill-equipped to fight it. They're obviously unaware of the spies within their midst. Hezbollah lost one of their chieftains, and they said since this guy's not on social media at all, no electronic footprint at all, they believe it came from the inside. So they're arresting a bunch of Hezbollah agents. And in Hamas, it took a while, but they finally killed the numbers two of their military wing, and we'll see how long Sinwar lasts, and we're just bracing for what could happen there. With me right now in studio is Link Loren. He's a former RFK Jr. Campaign advisor, political commentator. Hey, Link, welcome back.
Great to be with you. How are you doing, Brian?
Good. The world's on fire.
Yeah, I know. Markets crashing, careening toward World War III. Our president, we have a zombie in the Oval Office. So just a great Monday.
Right, but that zombie's in charge, and the vice president, for the longest time, was looked at as a national joke is suddenly the next coming of Indira Gandhi, Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, and Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, the same people who just a few weeks ago said Kamala Harris could never win a general election, now they're saying she's the savior of democracy, so I don't know how we're supposed to believe them.
Right, so, but also they also say in the same breath, they're indeed underdogs. How, yeah. Put in context the change, because Trump had basically a 4 or 5 point lead in every place, in school, mm-hmm. including Minnesota and Virginia,
right.
And now that's changed. Why?
Well, I think Kamala Harris is this shiny new object. She seems to have been able to detach herself from the Biden administration. She's not getting blamed by the mainstream media for any of the Biden-Harris administration failures. So she's been able to reinvent herself as the shiny new object. But she's hot to trot right now. I've been saying what goes up must come down. She's getting a lot of good press. But I think this honeymoon phase is coming to an end.
But not if before today she'll probably dominate. It wasn't for the market with the VP pick. And then we'll see the beginning of the DNC.
Right. I think from now to August 22nd, she's going to eat up a lot of the airwaves, which is why I've been suggesting to Trump, lay low, go play golf, let her eat up all the airwaves, let people miss
you. He's not doing much this week.
Yeah, he's not doing much this week. I think that's good. Lay low, let people miss you, and let Kamala really be, you know, raked over the coals for once. You know,
here's what Jonathan Martin said on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, who's awful, by the way. He's with Politico. Cut three.
It's going back to where this campaign was at the outset of the year, which is a slight Donald Trump lean, but only in the slightest sense. Obviously, the party in power is not popular right now. And we're back to, frankly, George, where we've been in politics for the last 9 years. If this election is about Donald Trump, the Republicans are going to lose. If it's about the Democrats and not Trump, then Trump has a chance to win. That's been the recurring theme for 9 years now, and it's the question in this campaign once again.
Link, do you challenge that?
I mean, I definitely think this should be a campaign about issues and policy. I mean, Kamala Harris's record is bad enough on face value. We don't have to talk about, is she black? Is she Indian? Is she this? Is she that? She oversaw the worst immigration crisis in American history. She's been an abject failure. Look at the markets right now. Biden was also supposed to be this peace candidate, and Kamala was supposed to help him. We've got war in Ukraine, war in the Middle East, unrest in South America. So, no, I think it should definitely be an election on policy.
Right. Here, I want you to hear what Rich Lowry said. For one thing, President Trump is making some mistakes. Mm-hmm. I think going after Brian Kemp's a huge mistake.
Right.
Saying she has a low IQ is a huge mistake.
Right.
Well, what's the sense of, Sam, number one, doesn't. You pass law school just because you pass, fail the bar. A lot of good people fail the bar the first time. You could just run on either. You could run on her as AG, DA, senator, vice president. Pick one.
Right. Yeah, I don't know exactly what Donald Trump is doing. I know he has great people around him, but sometimes you got to let Donald Trump be Donald Trump. With any candidate, you have to let them be themselves. And there were a lot of people in 2015 who said, what the heck is this guy Donald Trump doing? Why is he picking fights about this or about this? And he ended up winning. So maybe he knows what he's doing. I just would attack Kamala Harris on the issues, because Kamala Harris would love for this election to be a referendum on race, gender, overall decorum. Don't let her make it about all of that. Make it about the actual issues.
So what are people saying online? That's where you spend a lot of your time.
Yeah, I mean, young people are pretty energized around Kamala Harris. They're excited to have someone new, but it's not really Kamala Harris. If you look back at those polls, I'm sure you remember, Brian, they would do those polls, generic Democrat versus Donald Trump. She's basically doing what generic Democrat would have done. You could have slotted anyone in who's not Joe Biden, basically, and has a pulse, and who's under 80 years old, and they'd probably be doing about as well as Kamala Harris.
Right. So I want you to hear what Rich Lowry said. Cut four.
Donald Trump, 3 weeks after the first debate, had the best general election period he's ever had, besides nearly being killed. That aside, it was fantastic. And now the last week has been his worst week in this election. And there's always been this internal contest that just has to do with Trump. Will he do more to try to remind people of what they liked about his time as president, or will he do more to remind them what they didn't like about how he conducted himself? And the last week, it's definitely been the latter.
If I were Donald Trump, I would focus on reminding people about 2017 to 2019, right? People remember the good economy, the good stock market, businesses were flourishing. That's what I would be focusing on, trying to bring people back to that. Especially today, the markets are crashing. People are more stressed economically than ever before. Young people, their top concern is, how can I afford a home? How can I have equity in an asset like that in the way my parents did, my grandparents did? That's what I'd be going out there and talking about.
How come she's getting away without at least media outrage that she's not doing interviews. Why is there no outrage about
this? It's been weeks since Kamala Harris was coronated, and she hasn't been asked any in-depth hardball questions. She was coronated on a Sunday afternoon by the donor class, Nancy Pelosi. She's been able to coast ever since then. I think we should ask Kamala Harris some tough questions. I'd love for her to come in here to Fox and answer some tough questions. She should be on every single network.
I mean, at the very least, she's changed her position on 12 different... on 12 different major issues.
No, on a Monday, she says she wants to ban fracking. On Tuesday, she's saying, drill, baby, drill. You can't keep up with Kamala Harris. I think what you have to remember is Kamala Harris doesn't stand for anything, right? Kamala Harris got a big lucky break in 2020 when she was chosen as VP. She didn't even make it to the Iowa caucus. She was an abject failure in the primary. She's now gotten another big break being coordinated by the DNC. So she really doesn't stand for much. She's just a vessel for the donor class.
Do you think there's a story behind what led everyone to go for a June debate? Why challenge Trump on a June debate? If they don't do that, Joe Biden is the nominee and he's at the DNC and he's still trailing.
So I said it the night of the June 27th debate, and I still believe it today. I think Joe Biden was the sacrificial lamb. I think they put him out on stage hoping they would just get enough material so there would be irrefutable evidence he could not be the nominee. His team knew he was not doing well. The prep wasn't going well. He was taking naps. He was resting at Camp David. There's no way they put him on stage thinking he's going to perk up. It's going to be a great debate.
Someone on the inside didn't want him, knew how much he was failing.
That would be my guess. They could have pulled anything to get out of that debate, to postpone it. They sent him out on stage looking the way he looked. I don't know what type of wife. This is my thing with Joe Biden and Hunter as well. I know they're greedy. They're power hungry, and that's what drives them. In fact, everybody's quitting at the White House. I think Joe and Jill are the only people left swiveling around in their chairs. But they send Joe Biden out on stage. What kind of wife allows her husband to go out on stage in front of the entire country and humiliate himself and then get online an hour later and say, you did so good, Joe. You were amazing. I don't know what family allows that to go on.
I want you to hear. So Nancy Pelosi is more responsible for his ousting and stab in the back than anybody else. Mysteriously, she wanted to maybe clean up the record with Leslie Stahl on CBS This Morning, Cut 16.
Please tell us what you told President Biden to persuade him to step aside.
Well, I've never shared any conversations with the President of the United States publicly, no.
It's said that he's furious at you. Is he?
Well, he knows that I love him very much.
I understand that you don't want to own this. But it is so well reported that you were the leader of a pressure campaign.
No, I wasn't a leader of any pressure party. Well, let me say things that I didn't do. I didn't call one person. I did not call one person. I could always say to him, I never called anybody.
Wow, thanks. I never called anybody. I went on national television and told everyone to go throw him overboard.
No, here's what Nancy Pelosi meant. When Nancy Pelosi said, I did not call one person. Yeah, you called 36. You called 50 people. You called many people. Nancy Pelosi is the mob boss on Capitol Hill. When she says, I did not call one person. Yeah, you called about 100 people.
Right.
Nancy.
So you used to work with RFK. Why'd you leave?
Yeah, I think when I was there, you know, I was there for about 8 months. Some of the core values and policies of the campaign shifted, and I really didn't think I could be that additive anymore. It's very tough when you're the campaign's only public surrogate and you're going on Jesse Waters or going on these shows, having to answer for a campaign, and they can't articulate some of their own policies, right? Their policies are changing. One week he's, you know, pro-choice. One week he's pro-life. Then he doesn't know how he feels on this. So it became very difficult to do my job. But since I left the campaign, I've never bashed them. I don't talk about internal stuff that's been pretty well documented. I've tried to take the high road. I think now that it's kind of end of days, we're getting closer to the election, it's more fun to talk about the campaign. They're kind of just chilling a little bit. I don't feel so bad talking about it.
Right now, but he takes, you know, double figures, 10% here, 10% there. They say he's on 41 states. But now New Yorker's coming out with another devastating feature. And he said one of the things he wanted to do is get in front of this bear story. So the way I understand it, him and his friends were doing falconing.
Falconing, yes. No, Bobby is very into falconing. If you know anything about our campaign or the Kennedys, they love to go falconing.
All right, so let's listen to some of his explanation how it ended up with a bear in Central Park.
One man in a van in front of me hit a bear and killed it, a young bear. So I pulled over and I picked up the bear and put him in the back of my van because I was going to skin the bear. And it was very good condition, and I was going to
and put the meat in my refrigerator. And you can do that in New York City.
Okay. What? So he says the guy in front of him hit a bear. That's what he said.
Uh-huh,
and then he
allegedly
just picked up the bear. It's a cub. And they had an idea. And here's the idea. Let's listen.
I wasn't drinking, of course, but people were drinking with me who thought this was a good idea. And I said, I had an old bike in my car that somebody asked me to get rid of it. I said, let's go put the bear in Central Park and we'll make it look like he got hit by a bike. funny for people. So everybody thought that's a great idea. So we went and did that. And we thought it would be amusing for whoever found it or something.
I just love the last time I'm here, you're asking me, did RFK Jr. really eat a dog? And now we're talking about, did he bury a dead baby bear in Central Park? What's going to happen next? Is he going to, you know, kill a whale, get swallowed by a whale? What's going to happen next time I come around here, Brian? But this feels like a story from The Hangover, like a bunch of guys getting together and then they have to piece the night back together. What I don't understand is, I thought this story happened decades ago. I didn't know he was 60 years old. I don't know 60-year-old men running around parks in the middle of the night planting bears as jokes, right? That's just not something I ever see.
How do you lift a bear and put him in your car and then bring him down from Goshen, New York,
right,
back down to Central Park? And they want to make people think that it was, oh, my God, this bear got hit by a bike and died.
Yeah, I mean, what a prankster, what a jokester. What really kind of irked me, though, is that you have these underpaid sanitation maintenance guys in the city who are going to have to clean up after your joke. You know, you've got young kids who could have stumbled upon the bear. This little old lady's out walking her dog, and she sees this dead bear in Central Park. So I don't love that he was laughing about the helicopters overhead and it turning into a crime scene. If this wasn't New York City where we have actual real issues, I'd maybe say, ha ha, it's a gag. But like I said, I thought this was like a fraternity, something that happened in his 20s, very Animal House vibes. Right. I didn't know he was in his 60s.
Link Lawrence here. And Link, and finally, if this is the fix to get ahead of a story,
right,
how bad is the actual story? There's something. I mean, it's actually whatever we just described, it's worse as New Yorkers going to write it.
Yeah, I've heard different versions of the story. What's funny is my first few weeks on the campaign, he and his family and friends would always talk about he loves to pick up roadkill. He'll pick up anything on the side of the road. I never imagined a bear. I never imagined a bear.
Wait, I know he picks up roadkill.
He's known for his daughter-in-law told me my first day on the campaign, Bobby will pick up anything. If it's on the side of the road, Bobby's going to pick it up. I'm not thinking a freaking bear, and then you transport it into Central Park. Never would have crossed my mind.
So
Brian,
I mean, I know they're out to get him because they both camps look at it as a threat. Mm-hmm. But Democrats actually move on this. So do you believe that they see him as a threat? That's 5 to 10, 15%.
Yeah.
That could really flip some states?
I think right now, I love the Real Clear politics. I know some Kennedy supporters don't like it. They say, you know, the polls are skewed, and I know some polls are corrupt, but he's a little over 5% in Real Clear politics. That's enough in some of these swing states, battleground states, where it's razor thin to affect the election, right? People think elections come down to millions of voters. It's a couple thousand in a few counties across 5 or 6 states, right? He could definitely change the election, but if any of the candidates lose this election, it's going to be because of them, right? You can't really blame him as a spoiler. You have your own
Misteps. Instead they blame Jill Stein, too.
Yeah, in 2016, for sure.
All right, Link, so are you going to the DNC?
Oh, hell no, I'm not going to the DNC. I'm not dealing with the chaos. There are going to be protesters for Palestine. I will be at home, relaxing, covering it. I'm not going.
The best vice president pick for Kamala Harris is?
I always say Shapiro. If people want it, if he's who people are talking about, choose him. You know, why throw in a wild card?
All right, Link Lauren, thanks so much. If people want to follow you, where do they go?
Just follow me, Link Lauren. Type it in on Google. It's Link Lauren everywhere. Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Go get him. Back in just a moment, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Understand this, and I'm going to say this as clearly as I can. Anybody that has ever listened to anything that the progressive left has ever said has lived to profoundly regret it. I'm literally on every issue, they're dead ass wrong. These people are not just wrong, they're literally walking catastrophes. And the faster people realize that, the better off they're going to be. I wish she'd tell them all to go f*** themselves.
Yeah, but she's part of it. That's how she came up in California. James Carville can't get a sentence out without cursing. But he's right. But the progressive left, that's what we're saying on this channel. It's not Democrat or Republican. It's what they're proposing would destroy our economy and make us more allied to China. We're destroying the economy with this new Green Deal that they are jamming down our throats today. Now, I don't know if James Carville says just don't listen to him, but do it. Or he just understands that this is detrimental. Detrimental to the country, certainly not with the American people. Nobody wants to do this crap. The electric car mandates are destroying the car auto industry. And if these union heads weren't sold out to the Democratic Party, they would stand up for their own party. Like this head of UAW seems just like a terrible guy. That's everything you don't want to see about. But the one thing that Tulsi Gabbard was talking about, I read the headline when it came to Joe Rogan, said Joe Rogan thinks that Trump's going to lose. And I thought to myself, where'd that come from? Joe Rogan thinks that Trump's going to lose? Does he really say that? So I went and listened to the podcast, the whole thing with Mike Malice. He said, let me just hear it. They go on forever. Sooner or later, it'll pop up. Well, sure enough, it came up right in the beginning. And Mike Malice came out and said, no, I don't think he's going to win. Well, why do you think he's going to win? He goes, well, the press has given such an easy time. He goes, I don't think she should win, but she could win. And Change Side could win. So Joe Rogan, the most popular, impactful podcaster by far, nobody's close, comes out and says Trump's this or Trump's that. That matters. In some ways, it's like Taylor Swift, almost, although you'd expect Taylor Swift to be to the left entertainer. Joe Rogan, you don't really know. So when he comes out and says, in what this breath, I think that Harris is going to win, that's a big deal. People are running on that, talking about that, but then you got to listen to in context. He didn't say it at all. So I encourage you. When you see these headlines, for Trump, against Trump, whatever, just say, look, can I hear the whole thing? Don't jump to the conclusion. Say, I just need to hear the whole thing. I will not make an opinion to your family and friends until I hear it in context. And I certainly am not going to go on headlines and think that's the fact of the story. A lot of times the story dispels the headline.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. This hour, we're going to speak to Trey Yinks at the bottom of the hour, really in the eye of the storm in the Mideast. Might be the best reporter, one of the best reporters in the world. And he's speaking comprehensively about what could be happening in Tel Aviv, what could be happening in Gaza, what could be happening with attacks from Hezbollah, Houthis, and Iran all at the same time. What would happen to Israel then with us standing by and Jordan looking like they're ready to pitch in? So he's at the bottom of the hour. But right now we're joined by Gerard Baker, The Wall Street Journal. One of the great things, Gerard, about being in this building is you guys are here. The Wall Street Journal's here.
Just get in the elevator, go up.
New York Post, Wall Street Journal.
Flights, Fox. Here I am. We're all here. All on one,
Fox Business.
One happy family under one lovely roof.
I think one of the first. When did you guys move here?
2009.
Okay.
So, you know, News Corp, Rupert Murdoch bought the Journal in end of 2007. And wanted to move the Journal up, and it just took about a year to get it. So it was 2009.
It was great for me to find out, to talk to you guys in 2008, because we had Fox Business launching,
yeah,
and saw the market fall apart.
Right.
And I'm thinking to myself, what is going on? What is with these mortgages? Because for a person that doesn't do it every day, you just have to be smart enough to ask the right questions to experts like you. Now we're witnessing the market dropping 1,000 points. Mm. Now, the job numbers were bad, but they weren't terrible. I mean, 144 was 114.
Yeah. Exactly.
Unemployment's up to 4.3%. Interest rates not dropping. How does that combine to give us a global panic?
So I think it's a number of things. I mean, the market was down end of last week too, repeatedly. So this is the third day in effect of quite substantial falls, the biggest one of all. That's partly due to those jobs numbers, as you said. Friday, the jobs numbers were disappointing. Not terrible. We're not, you know, we're still positive jobs growth. But the unemployment rate has gone up. The unemployment rate has now gone up by almost a whole percentage point in the last year. So there's no question the economy is slowing. There's concerns that the Fed is just behind the curve on this, that, you know, we had the FOMC meeting last week. Jerome Powell came out and basically seemed to be quite relaxed and said, you know, still concerned a little bit about inflation. They weren't worried about the jobs market. There's a bit of concern in the markets that the Fed, you know, having missed inflation when inflation was the problem, is now in danger of missing the downturn when the downturn is the problem. So there's that. There are some technical things too. Japan had an incredible night last night.
Incredibly
there's
bad.
Been a big, terrible, terrible. The Japanese Nikkei was down 12%. And that's to do with basically, Japan's had 0% interest rates for a long time. People have been borrowing money in Japan to buy a lot of stocks around the world, including in the US. That's called the carry trade. Well, interest rates in Japan have started to go up, and it's likely that interest rates in the US are going to start coming down finally when the Fed does it. So there's a bit of concern. So that's led to that. So look, we've got all these, and then you've got this uncertainty in the Middle East, the fears of an escalation leading to maybe even a global conflict. So there's a lot of reasons to be nervous right now about the state.
So tell me if I'm thinking this too much. The fact that the Fed, let's say they're competent, right? We know how smart they are, but let's say they're competent. And the fact that they didn't drop rates means that they're seeing things that inflation isn't far from tamed, because they would love to drop rates.
Yeah.
Is that what people are trading off of?
I think, again, that's a possibility that they may see, you know, what people call stagflation as a risk. Powell didn't indicate that last week. I think, look, they haven't got inflation back to where it's supposed. This is their problem. They want inflation back down there. Their core 2%. Measure of inflation to 2%. It's still just a little bit above that. I mean, it's come down a lot, and it's not far off 2%. But they, having screwed up, let's be honest, on inflation over the last couple of years, they really don't want to risk, you know, letting up too early and letting inflation out of the bag. So maybe they're being excessively cautious on that and focusing more on that than on the other side of the balance sheet, which is the economy turning down, unemployment going up, the risk of a recession rising. It's maybe that they've got that balance wrong in the other direction this time, in that they're too aggressive about inflation and not accommodative enough to help the economy through what could be a downturn. So that's, you know, and again, that's one of the things the markets are worried about. That's why they think now, you know, a month ago, Brian, everybody was thinking, well, they would cut rates in September, but it would only be by 25 basis points, by a quarter of a point. Everybody now thinks they'll cut by 50, which is half a point. And actually, the markets are now indicating that the Fed will cut three times, probably by the end of the year, by 50 basis points at the first two occasions, and then by 25. So we're looking at, you know, a significant change in economic circumstances, and the concern that the Fed may once again be a little bit behind the curve.
See, I'm looking at my phone, not to ignore you, but I took a picture of this full screen. Gas is up 47% since Trump took office. Consumer prices are up 19%. Groceries up 20%. Electricity up 28%. Rent are up 21%. Credit card debt up 44%. So real average hourly earnings minus $1.93. So I don't care what anyone else says. You can hit them with every number. This is what people feel. Totally. Everything I mentioned is what the average person feels.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, when I say, when other people say,
and if I look paycheck to paycheck, what am I feeling?
When people say the inflation has come down, it's true. The rate has come down. The rate has come down from that. You know, we hit 9% on some measures a couple of years ago. It's back down to a little over between two and three. And that is, you know, the Fed, that gives the Fed some comfort that they can cut rates. But you know, the political point, or the broader economic point, is absolutely right, Brian, which is that the rate of inflation may have come down, but prices remain way, way above where they were 4 years ago. And this is why people feel, and especially because wages, as you say, have not kept pace for most people with those prices. It's why people feel bad. There's no reason. I find this, you know, this sort of ridiculous stuff in the media we keep reading about, oh, the economy is great, why do people feel so bad? The economy is not great when prices have gone up exactly as you said by 20% in the last 4 years, and wages have gone up by less than that. So you can have this situation where the Fed now may be needing to cut rates because the rate of inflation has come down without altering the fact that for most people prices are still much higher than they were 4 years
since
ago.
Since 2021, the unemployment's up 20%. Since 2021, inflation's up 40-year high. Since 2021, energy costs are up 50%. So good luck with that. When you look at energy, that's totally self-inflicted.
I mean,
we stop at the pop lines. Yeah. We pretend as if we allow drilling. But if you talk to people in that business, which you do, you know about these regulations that are cutting down, how they've federalized a lot of these lands, how they made it so hard for banks to invest in these drilling operations, which are always fundamentally, inherently a risk. So they go, yeah, I'm not against fracking, but I'm going to make it freaking tough for you to frack.
Yeah.
I'm going to make it very hard for you to drill. So then it's easy to go buy. And then you cut deals with Venezuela.
You
sell your soul to do it.
Look, I mean, oil and gas production in the U.S. has increased in the last few years, but it would have increased much, much more. Much, much more if there hadn't been these restrictive policies, both actual restrictive policies such as, you know, slowing down permitting for new oil and gas development, but also just the general climate here, which we know is hostile. This administration is hostile to domestic energy production. We would have had much, much higher natural gas and oil production in the last 4 years, which would have kept prices much, much lower. It's a very important point. Even as, by the way, oil and gas prices are now falling, and that's partly because of this fears of a, you know, maybe a global downturn and demand is slowing. Even though that's happening, again, we've seen this massive increase in prices over the last 4 years, a lot of which, you're right, on this can be laid at the door of the administration.
Gerard Baker's here from the Wall Street Journal. So this column is not out yet.
It's coming out this afternoon. Yeah.
Coming up in about an hour. The reinvention of Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
They want us to have everyone have short-term memory loss.
Yeah.
It was 2 months ago where she was the best prevention for Joe Biden's exit.
Exactly.
And now that she's it, they talk about how she's the perfect time for her second incarnation of Barack Obama. They think they can't believe how talented she is, how good she is. How long will this honeymoon last?
Well, so the question, as I ask at the end of my column, Brian, and thank you for mentioning it, is are they going to basically cover up for Kamala Harris the way they covered up for Joe Biden in the last 3 years? And, you know, what do you think the answer is? Right?
Well,
of course they are.
We're seeing.
Of course they are. They, you know, they did it for – they covered up the fact that Joe Biden was evidently increasingly incapable of doing the job. We have seen – everybody who's seen anything of Kamala Harris over the last 3 years knows that she's incapable of doing the job, and the media are going to cover for her again. And, you know, it is – and it's – by the way, it's not – this is not just like, you know, the Wall Street Journal editorial page saying this or Fox News or whatever. Brian, you probably had the same conversations. I had conversations with Democrats after that first debate, after that disastrous debate between Biden and Trump. And they were saying – you know, oh, my God, we're stuck because, you know, obviously he's got to go, but we really can't risk having Kamala Harris because, you know, her approval ratings are worse. She's unimpressive. She won't do a very good job as president. This was a month ago. A month ago, these people were saying this very same thing. These same people are now out there in public saying, yeah, she's the greatest thing since, you know, I describe her as, you know, we're supposed to believe she's a sort of a cross between Joan of Arc, Harriet Tubman and Margaret Thatcher. I mean, and all in the space. And these, by the way, again, these are the same people who were telling you a month before that first debate, Joe Biden was perfectly fine. He was perfectly capable. And all this stuff that he was incapable was all a kind of right wing plot.
Here's what Bob Cusack said of The Hill, Cut 5.
J.D. Vance reportedly said they felt sucker punched when they made the switch. I don't think they were sucker punched so much by the switch, but how she went from 14 points underwater, according to Harvard Harris, to now even. That's what surprised. The money coming in is unbelievable. And yes, Trump was up in, or at least tied in Virginia and in states like Minnesota and New Hampshire. Now we're back to a traditional map and the blue wall.
Do you see that?
It is. I mean, the numbers, he's exactly right. The numbers are there. But again, is that surprising? I mean, that's the media cover. That's what the media has. All we've had for the last, 2 weeks now since Kamala became the de facto nominee, all we've had is this endless adulation of, you know, stories about her personality, this ridiculous kind of media flummery of, you know, Beyoncé or Megan Thee Stallion and all these media people coming out to support her, all of this social, you know, all these memes that she's supposed to, God knows what they even mean, but, you know, Brad, we've had this, just this, she, you know, if you think about the way in which they have covered Donald Trump or J.D. Vance in the day, J.D. Vance, right, in the month or so since he became a kind of national figure, and compare that with the way they've covered Kamala Harris. The fact that her approval rating has gone from underwater to positive is a really powerful and disturbing indication, Brian, of how important favorable media coverage can be, because that's what we've had.
Right. What's also crazy is she totally gave up on the primary. She didn't get any primary votes at all. So 14 million people said, Joe Biden's my guy. You know why? Because the Democrats wouldn't let anybody run. Remember, RFK wanted to run. Right. Dean Phillips did run. Right. But these are minor players. Yeah. They cleared the field the second time like they did the first time for Joe Biden. Clyburn made sure of it. You want to be in the outs? You go ahead and run against Joe Biden.
Yeah.
I like to know who was behind the push to do the June debate.
I've spoken to some people on that. I've done some reporting on that. And I think there was a lot of internal debate in the Biden administration. I'm told Biden was determined to do it himself, that he wanted to show people, you know, it seems laughable now that we even think about it. He wanted to show people that he was up to the job. There is a conspiracy theory. I'm not sure I buy it, but there's a conspiracy theory that there were those people who were so alarmed about Biden, thought he couldn't possibly win, who wanted him to do the debate and do it early enough so that he would have a disastrous performance and then he would be forced out. To me, that's a bit too cute. I don't think really, you know, politics really works like that. I prefer to believe the idea that Biden himself was so arrogant and so self-assured. But there was I do know for sure, Brian, that there was a really fierce internal debate about that, and there were some very serious advisors who thought it would be a disastrous idea for him to do that because he would fail, and that would lead to. But actually, you know, again, I was talking to some Democrats at the weekend who said, you know, but you know, who knew it actually turned out to be possibly the best thing that could possibly have happened for the Democrats.
But if you look at the world, we look at the world right now. Eastern Europe in a major war could spread. Middle East is absolutely on fire. China trying to freeze everyone out of the South China Sea. Taiwan has never felt more threatened. So that is Joe Biden's foreign policy, and that's the good news. Let alone Afghanistan, and the talk now that they're getting millions and billions of dollars from us still, which is crazy. Follow that story. But then you have the economy being number one. You're watching it crater. No one feels it. Everyone feels it. Immigration being number two. Now, women's rights and Roe v. Wade, that's a top issue. But still, the economy doubles it. Do you still think that Trump's got the issues and the track record on his side?
Yeah. I mean, and in the end, that's why I still think Trump is the favorite here, even though the numbers are changing. And by the way, we're going to get more. We got another, as I say in my column, we got another 2 or 3 weeks of this.
Because you got the VP
Queen
pick.
Kamala stuff, because you got the VP pick this week, and we will be told this is the greatest person who's ever lived, and this is the great example of American diversity, the two of them at work. We'll get a week of that, of this incredibly positive coverage of that. Then we're going to have the convention. As I say, we're going to have the first night is Biden night, when all of these people who knifed Biden and said he was incapable of being president are now going to say, literally, as Nancy Pelosi did yesterday, that he should be on Mount Rushmore. And then we're going to have 3 days of what I call the pantsuit Pericles, you know, a praise to her. So we've got another 2 or 3 weeks of really, till the end of August, pretty well, a positive Kamala and whoever the VP is coverage. And that's probably going to put her maybe 2 or 3 points up. So, but I still think, right, coming back to your point, I think the issue still, she is still going to have to run in effect as an incumbent. She's going to try to avoid the press. She's going to try to avoid talking about any issues whatsoever, as far as I can make out. It's all going to be Trump, 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 and, you know, I'm the first black woman to be president of the United States, all this stuff. She's going to do all of that, but I still think those issues you mentioned, the economy, the state of the world, immigration, are going to, in the end, going to be most important.
Well, this was not helpful in my view. Cut 27.
Your governor, Kemp, and Raffensperger are doing everything possible to make 2024 difficult for Republicans to win. That, what are they doing? I don't know. They got something in mind, you know. They got a little something in mind. Kemp is very bad for the Republican Party. Under these kinds of woke radical left policies, Atlanta is like a killing field. And your governor ought to get off his ass and do something about it.
Your thoughts?
I think it's just, you know, it's an example of Trump's fundamental flaw, which is this incredible indiscipline he has, right? I mean, and Georgia, he just has a track record with it, right? I mean, he lost Georgia by, we can argue about, you know, I know he doesn't think he lost Georgia, but he lost Georgia by 11,000 votes in the election in 2020. Then he comes out and basically tells people, essentially tells people not to vote in those Senate runoffs, costing 2 Senate seats and control of the Senate, because the Republican turnout dropped dramatically, in part because of what he did. Then he comes out and backs Herschel Walker in 2022. He was a terrible candidate, let's be completely honest about it. Costs again the chance to make gains for the Republicans. And here he is doing it again. And Georgia is a swing state. Now, it looks the polling has him ahead, you know, 2 or 3 points. I think there was a poll at the weekend with Harris, maybe just a couple of points behind. He seems to be going out of his way to alienate voters in Georgia, and a critical state, which could, again, decide the result of the election. I don't, you know, it is the problem with Trump, whatever you think about. You know, you've heard what I think about the Democrats, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but it is all about him in the end. And if it's all about him, then that's not going to serve the Republican
Party. It helps Democrats. Hopefully he'll snap out of it. The reinvention of Kamala Harris out now in the Wall Street. Oh, shout out shortly.
Yeah,
in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah,
Jerry, always great to talk to you.
Brian,
thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You got it.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we're back. I mean, this is almost laughable. I mean, they say, like, oh, you know, in the summer is going to be slow in between conventions. I'm literally looking at this. Think about this. You have a hurricane, Hurricane Debbie, slamming into the south, northern Florida, Georgia, North Carolina. Got it. Always bad. Number two, you got Kamala Harris about to name a vice president, running mate. Usually this thing takes weeks and months build up. She has to do it really quick. She's scheduled to be in Pennsylvania tomorrow with a running mate. So it's got to be any minute now. And then at the same time, you have this challenging economy where the market has crashed. I wouldn't say crash. Let's just say the market's down 1,000 points, and 3 days last week it was down considerably. And now this is how we start the day. The futures were down, and now the market's down again. So I don't say this in a way in which, even though it looks better for Trump and his economy, and no longer can anyone even pretend that Bidenomics even has a good side to it, because unemployment's now no longer a staggering 3.3. It's at 4.3 and going the other direction. And then the market's all down. You can't say, well, look at the market's been up under me. Not so much. And then you look at what's happening in the world. And I'll tell you, a lot of this stuff, and a lot of it goes right back to the spending. They could try to pretend as if Donald Trump's responsible, but it's laughable. It goes to show you, when the economy's double digits in your direction, it should help. But the honeymoon continues with Kamala Harris.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We've been very, very consistent about not wanting to see this war escalate and get broader. We've also been very, very consistent about proving, not just with words, but with action, that we're going to stand up and defend Israel. I mean, on April 13th, when Iran launched 300 missiles and drones, the United States had aircraft fighter planes in the air to knock them down. We've now added additional naval and air assets to the region to help defend Israel again. I think we've proven time and time again that we're going to support Israel.
We'll see, but not without a lot of derision and a lot of consternation and a lot of reluctance. And that's why that Axios story leaked out, in my view, of President Trump's call with Benjamin Netanyahu, when one of the lines that he said is, don't BS me, to Netanyahu, as if he was being tough on him, talking about negotiations after the takeout of and the confirmation of the death of DF in Gaza, second in military wing of Hamas, and the Hezbollah leader in his apartment in Lebanon, and then Haniyeh being killed in his bungalow or his condo when he went for the inauguration of the Iranian president, a bomb that might have been placed there weeks ago. Trey Yinks joins us now because Iran has promised massive retaliation. Hey, Trey, can you set the scene for us? How are you?
Yeah, Kilmeade, I'm doing well. And as we talked about today on air, this story is developing so quickly, and there are so many parts at play. You have the political scene going on in Washington today, President Biden meeting with his National Security Council, trying to determine the role that the Americans are going to play in all of this. As we speak, the CENTCOM commander, Michael Carilla, is in Tel Aviv, and he's meeting with Israel's Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant. And then you have a country that is bracing for what is expected to be a massive Iranian attack in the coming hours or days that could cause significant damage to Israel. Right now, we are reporting from Israel's third largest city of Haifa. It sits about 17 miles from the Lebanon border, and it has many strategic targets that Iran may choose to hit during this retaliation.
So what might they be? Last time they told everyone we're bombing, it's going to be through rockets, and it's going to come this hour. And Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the U.S., U.K. were able to combine efforts in order to knock most of those rockets and missiles out of the sky. What are they telegraphing now?
Absolutely. The biggest Israeli concern right now, according to defense officials that I talked to overnight, is the lack of heads up they expect to receive from the Iranians this time around. In April, these officials described it as almost a game played by Iran. They wanted Israel to know what was coming. They wanted to give the Americans and coalition partners a chance to get jets in the sky and shoot down these incoming ballistic and cruise missiles. This time around, they may not be given so much of a heads up, and it could create a scenario where not only the coalition forces in the region that include American troops get overwhelmed as they try to intercept some of these incoming missiles and drones, but also Israel's air defense systems. There are three tiers of defense systems here. You have the Iron Dome, which is very well known. It's been used to intercept a lot of the short-range rocket fire coming from Gaza and some of it coming from southern Lebanon by Hezbollah. And then you have the David Sling and the Arrow system. And these are more advanced systems. They're capable of intercepting ballistic missiles, but they're not perfect. And as we've seen in the past, sometimes these missiles can slip through and cause damage to Israel. And so that's part of the concern here as we look at the situation, and also understanding that at any moment this attack could begin. And it has created a sense of panic among the population. Not panic in the traditional sense where you see people running to grocery stores and you see people queuing up at banks, but panic in the sense that people don't know what to expect. There are some people that are sending loved ones out of the country. You have 150,000 Israelis who can't actually get home because so many international airlines have canceled flights. And it is a feeling of uncertainty across this northern city and really across the country.
All right. So you have to, and you also, not you, but the Jerusalem Post has talked about maybe a preemptive attack. If the Israelis get word that Hezbollah is going to hit at such and such time, they're not just going to wait and get the Arrow system, David Sling, and the Iron Dome ready. They might hit ahead of time, right?
Absolutely. And when we think about what the Israeli response would be to any sort of strike, they've made clear that they are prepared to go to war over this situation. Iran has also made clear they're prepared to go to war. And so we're really at the brink of a massive conflict that could unfold in the Middle East. And if the Israelis know that Iran is going to launch a large-scale attack that is going to cause the type of damage that's going to drag the country into war anyway, they're going to preemptively strike and try to get ahead of the Iranians. But the other key factor we have to talk about here is the possibility that Iran uses its proxies in the region to get more directly involved in the fight. Because as you noted, last week, what started this specific rise in tension, and I mean, we've been looking at a rise in tension since October 7th and the brutal massacre against the Israeli population on Black Saturday. But when we talk about what is taking place right now, we're looking at the possibility that Hezbollah, Iran's largest proxy in the region, gets involved in the fight. Now, Hezbollah has 150,000 rockets and missiles. Some of them are precision-guided with parts that were smuggled into southern Lebanon by the Iranians, and they're all aimed at Israeli population centers. So if Hezbollah gets directly involved in the fight, and this really does turn into a regional war, it will not be easy for Israel. There is a sense, I think, in the international community when we talk about this conflict, because how the Israelis have operated in Gaza, a relatively small strip of land, that they would simply be able to defeat any sort of attack. And while long term that is true, they're not going to be overrun as a country, they will face significant damage, especially from Hezbollah. Now, if Hezbollah fires on Israel and on population centers like Haifa, this northern city, or Tel Aviv, Israel's second largest city, you're going to see an Israeli response against Beirut, similar to the strike that you saw that killed that top commander in Hezbollah, who the Israelis say is responsible for a rocket attack on this community of Majdal del Shams that killed 12 young Druze children. But so if this happens, we're looking at something that we have not seen since the 2006 Second Lebanon War, and the Israelis, according to estimates, and I want to sort of dig back in here because we've got the time, about what this means. And we haven't even reported this on air, so this is the first time that I'm bringing this information out, but it's actually critical to report in the grand scheme of what we're covering here. I was in an Israeli intelligence briefing a couple years ago, and I asked the briefer, and I said, you know, how many rockets do you expect each day if this conflict does erupt? And they said in the early days of a war directly between Israel and Hezbollah, that is at the full scale, Israel could see up to 4,000 rockets and missiles each day. 4,000. That number would certainly overwhelm Israel's missile defense systems, and it would take millions of people to bomb shelters. They would be literally living in shelters for days. Comms would be cut, water, electricity, all of these critical things. And that's what Israel is preparing for, understanding that if Iran miscalculates, we are one single miscalculation away from that scenario.
Wow, pretty amazing. The damage will be done, but you know the downside of not doing anything and just de-escalating is we're putting off every day that goes by. It seems like Hezbollah gets stronger and Hamas is able to reconstitute unless they can be more significantly wiped out. And Iran seems to be getting stronger because they're selling so much oil. General Jack Keane says we made a mistake early. Listen, cut 37.
The horrific attack on October the 7th, Iran operationalized immediately all of the other proxies. On October the 8th, Hezbollah began to fire in northern Israel. The Iranian-backed Shia militias in Iraq and Syria, prior to October the 7th, had already fired at U.S. troops 125 times, and they stepped it up from October the 7th on, and the Houthis have effectively shut down the Suez Canal. And yet, to this day, we still do not hold Iran accountable for anything that I just said. And it's absolutely tragic, and it's a huge strategic mistake.
And we don't step in and give secondary sanctions to China for buying Iranians' oil. And we still did the $6 billion hostage deal where they a prisoner swap. So do you see that as fundamentally the issue?
There's a massive issue in the Middle East right now when it comes to deterrence, because Iran has been able to skirt sanctions. They have faced very little accountability for funding, training, and supporting these proxies like Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the Houthis and these Iran-backed Iraqi and Syrian Shia militias. And as a result, they feel that they can get away with attacks not just on Israel but on U.S. forces. I mean, we've seen hundreds of attacks on American bases in the region that have injured American soldiers and killed Americans. I mean, you remember in Jordan the deaths of U.S. service members as a result of an Iran-backed attack. And these things aren't really talked about so much. And what has been projected from the United States is from the perspective of Iran is that you can continue to get away with this.
Yes.
And it creates a scenario where they can operate, they can launch attacks, they can really do whatever they want, and they're not afraid of what will come next. And look, we should consider from their perspective too, and this is always critical in this reporting. I try to think through what are they thinking in this moment. And I can tell you what they are thinking is that last week, not only was a senior commander from their top proxy killed in an airstrike that Israel took credit for in Beirut, the Lebanese capital, which is largely considered a safe area for Hezbollah because it was off limits. There was a red line. Hezbollah always said they would respond if Israel struck Beirut. And Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, said that it would be an eye for an eye. If Israel strikes Beirut, Hezbollah will strike Tel Aviv. But beyond that, and really I think the critical point to talk about here is, as you noted off the top, the killing of Ismail Haniyeh, the political leader of Hamas. This is one of Iran's largest proxies. It's the second or third largest proxy, depending on how you count it. But it's an organization that had a leader in Tehran, in the Iranian capital, visiting as a guest. He was staying at an IRGC guest house. He was under the supervision of the Iranian regime. He was under the protection of the Ayatollah and the president, the new president, Masoud Pezeshkian, who replaced Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in the helicopter crash. And he wasn't just visiting to say hello. He was visiting for the inauguration of the country's president. And still, he was taken out in what appears to be an explosion with a bomb that was planted there maybe 2 months before. But so the Iranians feel that they have lost deterrence as well. They feel that if they don't strike back against Israel strong enough, that Israel will continue to take out not only Iranian officials, but also, as we've seen, the top officials from their proxies. Now, Israel has launched covert operations in Iran in the past. Mohsen Sahrzadi, there are a number of individuals who have been taken out by the Israelis, and there have sometimes been responses, sometimes haven't been responses. And that nuclear scientist I'm talking about is Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and he is the man responsible for Iran's nuclear program. The Israelis killed him with a remote machine gun on the back of a truck. The Israelis earlier this year, through the initial Iranian response, struck and killed seven members of Iran's IRGC, including Mohammad Sakhadi, at the embassy compound, you could say, a building linked to the Iranian embassy in Damascus, Syria. So Israel's not afraid to operate against Iran, and Iran feels that it has lost its deterrence. And it's part of the reason this is not a question of if Iran will attack. It's a question of when and how. So, and that's the question that is in the air today of Israel, waiting to see what that will look
and
like.
And Trey, there's such distrust now. In Hezbollah, for example, I heard there's massive arrests because they said the only way for this guy Shakur to be killed, because he had no footprint, no social media, no phone, was for someone on the inside to give up his location. So now there's some massive arrests and everyone's covering for themselves and they look at each other as, are you the spy? And I imagine the same thing is happening with massive arrests because that bomb evidently was placed weeks, if not months ago, in that house. By whom? An Iranian? Someone posing as an Iranian? A member of Mossad? A cleaning person? So that's caused massive distrust on the inside. Are you hearing this?
Absolutely. And that's a great point. There is some level of panic among the Iranian regime, understanding that there are men on the inside who are calling in this intelligence. And it raises questions, right? If you're the Iranian regime, then you start to ask yourself, what else do they know? Who else was giving information? You know, who else is at risk? If they were able to plant a bomb inside of an IRGC facility 700 meters away from the presidential residence, who's to say that there's not a bomb already planted somewhere else and they just haven't detonated it? I mean, it raises a question for the Iranian regime that the Israelis want raised. They want them to be in a state of uncertainty and panic. They are trying to destabilize the Islamic Republic because this is a country who says one of their key missions is to destroy Israel. And they're currently in the process of developing a nuclear weapon. They're enriching uranium at very close to weapons grade material. And the breakout time under this administration has gone from months to weeks.
Yes.
And then it will go from weeks to days. And then Iran will have a nuclear weapon. And what we're talking about right now, the whole dynamic changes.
I know. And I don't think Israel has shown they will do what they need to stay alive. The Holocaust is real. They'll never again is not just a catchphrase. They live it. And, you know, it's a thing to think about. And if they want to attack us in Syria and Iraq, if they kill an American, it's going to be a brand new calculus from the American population, if not the administration. Trey, it's a tenuous time, to say the least. Thanks so much for putting in perspective. Trey Yinks.
Thanks for having me.
And stay safe. I know you got fail-safe plans. All right, I'll try to squeeze in some calls when we get back. I see you in Palm Beach. I see you in Orlando. That was Trey Yinks from the Eye of the Storm. And by the way, we also do have an Eye of the Storm in the south part of the country. Amazing day. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
Do you know how weird it is when a prince knows your name? He's like, Joe Rogan's giving out dangerous vaccine misinformation. And my first thought was, did I? If you're getting your vaccine advice from me, is that really my fault? That's not my job, kids. I'm a professional talker, okay? Some of the things I say make sense. A lot of them don't. It's up to you to figure out what's what. Well, take this advice. Don't take my advice.
So funny. I missed his Netflix special. That was Joe Rogan, everybody. And this is More to Know. Joe Rogan over the weekend talking about something he went through, which is good, right? Because, I mean, he gets to talk 3 hours a day. You might as well find out what he thinks funny about the stuff that he's doing.
And also, I mean, he talks all the time about his stand-up and how much he loves stand-up, yeah. But to actually get to see him do it is nice, as opposed to just, you know, because we're not in Austin to go to his place to watch him.
Realize how much money he probably got for that. If he's getting $100 million for this podcast, to get him interested in doing a Netflix special,
yeah,
knowing that all he's doing is mentioned, it's going to get good ratings.
That's very true. I'm sure he's comfortable.
Next, Veep, which everyone says, I have not seen one episode of this.
Never?
Never.
Seriously, Brian?
All right. I'm going to start watching it. Brian, my son, urges me to. He says I will love
he
it.
He has excellent
Because I
taste.
Love Julie Reed. Yeah. She says she's going to be extra involved in Kamala Harris' election campaign and hints at a DNC appearance. Does that really matter?
Well, I mean, is she going to be there as herself, or is she going to have fun with the Veep stuff?
I
to
think
try
she,
to make it, like, it would you know, be go
funny.
Viral online.
It would be funny. She's hysterical. Next, Elon Musk responds to Don Lemon's lawsuit accusing Musk and X of fraud and reputational damage. Musk ended the deal after he had an interview with Elon Musk, with Don Lemon. He had $1.5 million signed Lemon just right after he signed Tucker. And he said this is what Musk said is the reason he fired him. He made a series of impressively insane demands. We declined. Therefore, no deal. I did. Didn't you hear about all those crazy demands?
I didn't, actually.
Yeah, it was crazy demands, and that I wasn't sure if it was confirmed or wasn't denied. But he had no job. Why he's trying to blow up the one guy to try to hire him, they just want to give him a platform, is nuts. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.